We're interested in finding out some information about connectivism. We know you're one of the founders, the creators of the whole methodology. Give us a brief description on connectivism, if you could, please.
Okay, the official brief description is that knowledge is contained in the links between interconnected entities, or as they're sometimes called, nodes, and learning is the creation of those connections and being able to traverse those connections. Now, what that means in a practical sense is that for an individual, learning is about growing the connections in the mind through immersive experience. It's a theory about the nature of knowledge and the idea that knowledge itself is composed of these connections, which means that there aren't single items of knowledge that you accumulate, but all of your knowledge layers in and over on itself. And so you don't learn one thing at a time. Anytime you're having an experience, you're learning a whole multitude of things. And what you're learning now is changing everything that you've learned previously and changed by everything that you've learned previously. On an even wider scale, what that means is putting yourself where you're interacting with people and connecting with them and traversing the connections in and among those people.
Wow. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Where do you see connectivism impacting the future of education? Like the way that it started, thinking of behavioralism and cognitivism and all these theories relating and crossing over each other. Where's connectivism taking us?
All of those other theories were theories about how to do education, mm-hmm. right? There are theories about how to teach. There are theories of pedagogy. Connectivism is a theory about how to learn. It's a really big difference. And I don't think people get the difference yet, because they look at connectivism as a theory of teaching, and then they say, well, maybe I'll just go back to cognitivism or constructivism or something, because it's kind of like that anyways. Right. But it isn't. So in its first instance, it sort of overturns this balance between teacher and student. Mm-hmm. And, it's not the first theory to say that students should manage their own learning, but it's the first theory that really explains why. And it's the first theory that really explains how a student should go about managing their own learning and what they're up to when they're trying to do that. So the big impact that it's going to have, that it is having already demonstrably, is in describing and supporting learning that takes place outside of formal institutions. Now, the idea of a connectivist classroom is almost an oxymoron. It's sort of like, free prisons or, you know what I mean?
Right.
Inside the classroom, the most you can expect is some of the things happening outside the classroom might reach in, although inside the classroom, that's where it's usually blocked. Outside of the classroom, you see these networks forming, you see these clusters of interacting entities, usually people, but not just people. That's why I say entities instead mm-hmm. of interacting people. Because resources linked to each other, services linked to each other, websites linked to each other, and people linked to each other. Mm-hmm. And you see the dynamic information flow through these networks. And that's how the general environment of learning changes. And your personal experience of that becomes an experience of being a part of something, engaging in a process, engaging in a practice, building things, creating things. It doesn't mean you don't ever remember things, but the point isn't simply the acquisition of you know, the memory of some sort of facts. The point is rather, you know, through this immersion to become something, to become a physicist, to become a computer programmer, which is much more than just the facts. It's this wide range of attitudes, beliefs, expectations, ways of speaking, and different other aspects of community.
Wow. Great. Thank you. Thank you. What are your thoughts on the argument of connectivism is only another form of a constructivism?
Well, connectivism isn't constructivism. I've just given you part of that argument. Constructivism is a theory about how to teach. And I had this argument with David Merrill at a conference once, because he went in there and he talked about constructivism and having the students, you know, make contracts with teachers, build their own knowledge. My response was, well, what if the student doesn't want to do that? You know, sort of like, well, they have to do that. And that's the big difference. Mm-hmm. You know, in connectivism, you can always leave.
Right.
In constructivism, you can't. Because the environments are totally different. Mm-hmm. There's also, but that's just one aspect. There's also a different theory of knowledge at work. Now, I need to be a bit careful, because one of the characteristics of constructivism is there's, you know, the 9 billion theories of constructivism. So every time you make a criticism of constructivism, someone comes along and says, oh, well, there's such and such a theory of constructivism that addresses that. And there's true, there always is. Is there one constructivist theory for every single objection that's ever been leveled against it? So there are constructivist theories that address this, but the representation of knowledge in connectivism is completely different from the representation of knowledge in constructivism. We go back to one of the catchphrases of constructivism, making meaning, mm-hmm. right? That's a concept that is literally incoherent in connectivism. You don't make meaning. Meaning isn't the sort of thing that you make. At the very, very best, and it's really stretching it, you might be able to grow meaning. But even that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. The thing is, in constructivism, there's a classicist approach to knowledge, or a cognitivist approach to knowledge, where knowledge is represented, where knowledge is composed of propositions. Knowledge is instantiated in the mind, whatever that is, and constructivism is generally, you know, silent on that. Knowledge is instantiated as a series of propositions. And when you're making meaning, what you're doing is you're taking these propositions and associating them with experience in some way. There are many ways of making meaning. The main point here is it's a representationalist theory of knowledge, mm-hmm. where there's a model of some sort, and the model stands for some kind of external reality, and then the meaning of the model depends on the connection between that external reality. That's not what connectivism says. First of all, in connectivism, knowledge is not propositional. There are not sentences in the brain. Well, what are they, you may ask? Mm-hmm. Connections between neurons. Mm-hmm. The connectivist theory is literally a physicalist theory in the way that constructivism is not. Constructivism, most versions, now again, there's 9 billion theories, so there are some exceptions, but most versions of constructivism are instantiations of what would be called the physical symbol system hypothesis, that there is a physical state somewhere in the mind that is at the same time the symbolic state, and the properties of the symbolic state, the semantical and syntactical properties, are in some way instantiated in the physical state. Or, as Jerry Fodor would say, there are sentences in the brain, right? Yeah. Connectivism, no sentences in the brain.
Right.
There is no physical symbol system. That does not mean that there is no experience of symbols, or course there is. It would be ludicrous to claim otherwise. But what these experiences are not strings of symbols. They are the activations of neural connections. An experience of reading a sentence like Paris is the capital of France is of the same type, the same sort of thing as looking at a sunset or petting your cat or whatever. It's a memory that you have where this memory is composed of a set of symbols. So it's the kind of memory, but it's not a difference in type from other memories. In cognitivist theories, there's a difference of type between your memory of Paris as the capital of France and your memory of petting your cat and your cat. And in fact, that's how they actually build their meaning, right? Because they associate memories of this type with memories of this type and say, oh yeah, okay, now I've made meaning. But all they're doing, it's a little game because it's just associating one type of memory with another type of memory, but saying the other type of memory is the real physical world and this type of memory has special properties. It's got grammatical properties, semantic properties, it's truth preserving, all the rest of it. I can go through a whole list of them. So in a connectivist perspective, your experiences create connections between neurons. That's a phenomenon known as plasticity. And there are different ways this can happen. You can have, in early age, for example, you have a lot of connection between a lot of neurons, and your experience actually results in a trimming down of those connections. It's the use it or lose it phenomenon, right? And if you don't have the experience in early life, the initial connection that was created withers and goes away. So in later life, you build new connections, or more frequently, you vary the amount, the strength of the connection from one neuron to another, so you can strengthen them and weaken them. In connectivism, knowledge is distributed, which is to say, the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France isn't located in some particular place. Rather, as I say, it's that knowledge, if we were to isolate, you can't even really isolate it, but pretend we could, then that knowledge would be a whole series of connections between different neurons, and each of those connections would have a certain level of strength, a certain level of strength associated with it. And that would be your knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. Nothing over and above that. There isn't some other thing that knowledge refers to or represents. We can speak hypothetically and say that it represents some state of affairs in the world, but that's not where the meaning comes from. The meaning, such as it is, comes from it being the way it is, mm-hmm. right? So there's no way of making meaning here. It is what it is.
Right, connected. So, mm-hmm. And it seems like it's a lot of brain-based learning, a lot of brain research that goes into the connectivist approach.
That's right. Now, and I want to be clear, right? If the research in neurophysiology changes, connectivism changes. My understanding of connectivism is based on my best understanding of neurophysiology the way it stands now. So when I'm saying, there are strengths of connections between neurons, that's because, to the best of my knowledge, they find strengths of connections between neurons. Right. If Fred, neural researcher, came along tomorrow and said, oh, they're all the same strength, we'd have to revise the theory. It's empirically based. Mm-hmm. It's also mathematically based. It's based on the principles of graph theory. And again, if graph theory changes, the theory's going to have to change with it. Mm-hmm. And the postulates, I've talked about the properties of effective networks. These are, first of all, empirical predictions, right? These are the things I think make effective networks. But if it turns out they don't, then the theory changes. But they're also based on the best evidence that I have that these are in fact the things, right? So it's not like you know, I have the opinion, you know, it's like, it's my belief that diversity is good, right? And I'm a believer in diversity. Well, no, that's not where it comes from, right? It's not that I have this deep-seated belief in diversity. It's observationally, networks that are diverse are more stable. Mm-hmm. Now, if observationally that proves not to be the case, then my views on diversity change. Mm-hmm. You know, no, I don't expect that to happen. You know, but
it's possible.
But it's possible, right? And then there's a third major pillar, and that's computational. Mm-hmm. Connectivism is based on the computational theory of connectionism. And what connectionism shows is certain semantical... Sorry, Miguel Zapata. You don't know Miguel Zapata, right?
No.
So I'm going to have to decline. I don't usually leave Skype on for a long period of time. So mm-hmm. I'm not used to dealing with incoming calls. connectionism talks about being able to do certain logical properties, and there's a bunch of phenomena associated with connectivist computer theory. For example, cluster formation. If you have a connectivist network, you send input into the network, just the way sensory input would come into the human mind, and that's what they're trying to emulate, you get a natural clustering of phenomena. And that, you know, that can be tweaked and changed depending on the nature of the connections between the entities. There are all kinds of different properties you can change in these entities. For example, if you have one entity and another entity, and the first entity sends a signal to the second entity, how many of these signals does it take before the second entity responds? That's a variable, right? There's a whole bunch of variables like that that are described in connectionism. And there's a relation between being able to describe those variables, tweaking those variables, and performing inference, description, classification, categorization, pattern recognition, and a number of other phenomena. So as the research in connectionism goes, so does the theory of connectivism. It follows along that as well. So those are, and because it's based in that specifically, but you know, you don't find any equivalent to any of this in constructivism. You know, again, there is a theory of constructivism out there. You can find some writing that talks about neural networks, mm-hmm. but it doesn't connect up or explain in any meaningful way. Right. The connection between quote unquote making meaning and the fact that we're a neural network, right? Mm-hmm. It's like constructivism and it's wearing the neural network clothing today instead of the we're not behaviorism clothing today or whatever.
Mm-hmm. We're not. Excellent. We have another question for you. A lot of educators argue that without structure in education, teachers can't assess students' progress properly. How do you think educators could utilize connectivism to get their students to reach out and connect and still evaluate them in formative and summative manners?
If it's possible.
Yeah,
or if it's necessary.
Well, this is the freedom in a prison thing. Right.
Right.
Asking a question like that is like asking, how can we let prisoners run free without them escaping?
There's so many restrictions on us as teachers, it's hard to...
I completely understand. You're working in a very different project. I mean, you're working as teachers... You're working in a project where the task you've been given is to get people to remember things and to prove that they remember things by repeating them back to you.
Right. Which is not really learning. It's just...
Which is not really learning. So given that you're doing that...
Well, not all of us are, but we're forced to do that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's just it, right? I mean, the way I would view it, the way I do view it to a large degree, is you're doing that, but you also want to try to help your students learn while you're doing it.
But the
evaluation question is kind of tangential to that. So there's two different directions, right? How does connectivism inform traditional assessment? Or secondly, what would connectivism describe as an assessment?
Mm-hmm.
To take the second part first, because it's easier. When you work in a network, there are all kinds of traces of your activity in that network, all kinds of links, all kinds of messages sent back and forth, a huge pile of data. And the approach is, on a first pass, the approach is all of this data gives us a very clear picture of what place that person has in the network, how connected they are, how active they are, how much other people in the network are receiving them or are receptive to them, what sort of impact they have, etc. Now, this is not a test of memory, right? It's a test of engagement and participation. If you agree, though, that full engagement and participation would not be possible without the requisite knowledge, plus what other intangibles are involved, then this is just as good as a test. If you don't agree, then we're back to testing. But I think there's one line of inquiry, and George Siemens is doing a bit in the area of learning analytics. I'm not so much, I think of it more as a pattern recognition problem. I'm looking at it from that direction. Mm-hmm. But that's the direction, one way that assessment can be approached.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I think for any domain, if you represent that domain as a wide field of expertise, so the domain is actually a clustering in that field, you can hypothesize the center of that cluster. And then any person in that network, wherever they may happen to be, will be a certain distance from that center. And that distance from that center, what that distance measures is, you know, all of your communications, all of your interactions, whether what you do has any effect on others, etc. It measures the similarity between the things that you write and the things that other people write. So it's not just a popularity meter. That's really important. It's not a popularity meter. It's a pattern recognition thing. It's a similarity thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that distance from you to the center represents your, is the inverse of your degree of authority in that discipline. So somebody who's right at the center defines the discipline, right? They are the discipline. Nobody's ever right at the center,
mm-hmm.
because there's always somebody who disagrees with you, right? But people who are really close, they're the experts. People who are really far away, they're the novices, right? But as you engage, you get closer and closer and closer. What's really neat is that it's reflexive in that as you're getting closer and closer, you're becoming more and more expert. As you influence the discipline, the center of the discipline moves towards you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a test of conformity. It's because the nature of the discipline changes as well. So there is mathematics behind that. I'm not able to do them yet, but I have been talking with a mathematician friend of mine to see just what it would look like. I worked out a basic algorithm, but it needs to be cashed out further by people who are better at this than me. But that's the theory. What else was I going to say? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This one of our final questions are, how do you think connectivism can be applied in the business world?
Oh, well, I think in the business world, more than anywhere else, you have this huge need for informal learning or on-the-job learning. You know, anytime you take staff off the job and put them into a classroom, that's a net loss, right? You're paying people to do things other than their job. As well, learning that happens in one of those classrooms is, it's very artificial. Mm-hmm. It's very abstract. It's not learning that necessarily is going to work for them in the field. So you want their learning to be as tightly connected to their job as possible. Well, in all cases, their job is participation in this network, in some network, in all cases. There is no job that isn't participation in some kind of network or another. Mm-hmm. And if you can create and maintain a greater interconnectedness with that network, a greater responsiveness to that network, you're promoting learning and improve job performance at the same time, because it's one and the same thing. Practically, it means that, if you have sales agents, your sales agents should be using a wide range of technologies to connect with their customers, not just, the once a month sales visit, but email, phone calls, social networks, whatever. But it also means that salesperson using those networks as intelligence to learn about competitors, to keep abreast of developments in the fields, etc. If you're a construction worker, it means being plugged into the construction worker network, being up on code changes as they happen because you subscribe to, government RSS feeds or trade association RSS feeds. It means being part of your Facebook group for the local union or the local chapter. It means being connected to suppliers so that you know about nail guns or product recalls, whatever. I don't know much about construction, that's probably showing. But every single job that you can think of consists of one of these networks. Right. And what connectivism talks about is how do you set up the network for that environment to achieve the greatest possible learning impact? Now, right now, we're at the stage where we're talking about very vague generalities about these networks in general. I talk about autonomy, diversity. I'm talking about these networks in general. But every network is different. And over time, people in these networks, as they become more expert, are more able to understand what the characteristics of this particular network or that particular network are going to be. Because the entities will be different, the rules governing what makes a connection happen are going to be different, the clustering is definitely going to be different, there's going to be a lot of different phenomena in each one of these networks. The underlying principle still is the same. Interact with this network, get enmeshed in this network, and become more and more engaged.
How would you recommend that a way that people can identify good information using all these connections on the internet versus a bad resource or a bad connection? Because there's so much out there, and especially when you're teaching your students to make connections, or you're teaching your business worker, your colleagues to make connections, how can you guide them in the right direction? What advice would you give them?
Two things right off the bat. I can give them a whole course on
it. It's kind of a broad question, I'm sorry.
two things right off the bat strike me just off the top of my head as we're talking right now is really important. Number one, trust your own instincts, right? Because you have one of these connectivist systems, right? If it feels wrong to you, it probably is, right? And that's related to the second part. The second part is pattern recognition, right? You can, over time, learn to spot characteristically bad information. A really simple example, spam from Nigeria. The fact that it's from Nigeria right off the bat tweaks you, because how many people do you know in Nigeria?
Right.
This doesn't apply for everyone. Some people know lots of people in Nigeria, but I don't, you don't. If it's from Nigeria, the suspicion flag goes up. if the quality of the writing is really awful, it's another flag, right? These days, if it's from somebody that you've never heard of purporting to be your friend and asking them to send you $1,000 or asking you to send them $1,000, you know, that strikes me, you know. Or the common familiar pattern, if it's good, too good to be true, it probably is, right? That's pattern recognition. You're recognizing the pattern. It's too good to be true. There are different kinds of patterns that you can learn to spot. I can't go through them all, but trusting your instinct and then focusing on these patterns that are signs or indications that there might be something wrong with that. And, you know, and you might ask, well, how do you learn that? You learn that by being engaged in the network, because other people, when they hit these things, they're telling you. When you hit these things, you're telling them. And you're intuitive, if you will. When I say intuitive, I'm not talking about magical powers. I'm talking about your brain working automatically without conscious thought.
Like that red flag that goes up.
That's right, exactly. Your intuitive recognition that something is wrong is based not just on your experience. That's what's really important, is based not just on your experience, but the experience of everybody in the network who have been sending you communication all along. So you're gaining everybody else's experience as well as your own to inform that kind of pattern recognition.
Okay,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I have one more impromptu question. This wasn't on our original list. What is your favorite networking site?
Aside from my own?
We are on your blog already, but beside your blog.
I'm not really big on networking sites per se, because I think the network should be distributed, not focused on the site.
Okay.
Are you there?
And I use Google Reader because, you know, I can use it to access RSS feeds.
Right. Mm-hmm. So all of your different community feeds are in one spot.
Right.
Yeah. Right. You know, and that's simply because the interface is easy to deal with. You know, otherwise, you know, of the sites, I really like the way Google Plus looks and feels. I hate the fact that there's no RSS support, but I really like the overall feel of it. If I had to pick one, I'd probably pick Google Plus and hack something to make it work with RSS.
Excellent.
Well, thank you so very much. We were so excited that you took some time to share information with us, and we're going to be sharing this with the rest of the other 14 people that we know, and hopefully we keep in touch. We love maybe if you come to New Jersey, come and visit us.
Sure. I was going to say I've never been to New Jersey, but that's not true. I've been to the airport.
The airport. That gives us a bad impression.
Once, so I took a walking tour through Newark, so I've been to some of New Jersey.
The less beautiful parts. But thank you so much. Newark is pretty. In a sarcastic sense.
I thought of it as, classic American industrial city with, and that's what it is.
It is an industrial capital.
And that's its architectural style. That's the feel on the street. And for what it is, it's pretty good. So, I have different ways of appreciating cities.
Well, luckily you do. The televisions don't give us much credit here in New Jersey, but...
I don't watch any of those. I've heard of them, but I don't watch, like, the Jersey Shore.
No, we don't either. We live here. So we don't need to.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for explaining your theories and connectivism.
You're very welcome. If you want to send me a copy of that audio, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yes, we will.
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
And we give you also feedback of what our peers thought about it.
Sure, that'd be great. I'd love to hear that. Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
All right, great. Thank you
thank
so
you
much
again.
Have
a good evening.
Good evening. Bye.
Take care.
Bye.